This is Dr. Bill Mounts in his teaching on the Sermon on the Mount. This is session number 8, Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 and following, Acts of Greater Righteousness, part 3.
You know, while Matt's doing that, I'm going to answer your question. I already forgot who asked it. NIV. Oh, yes. What you understand, let me say something about the NIV and whether the TNIV has permanently affected it. From the beginning, the NIV has in its charter to constantly update. And so the committee has met every single summer for at least a week, always. And so the desire to update what isn't something new, it's what they've always done. And somewhere back, well before I was in the committee, the argument was made that language is changing so much that we need to start looking at changing the NIV. And they, in my mind, did a terrible job. It's the he and the mans that they had to get rid of, so they switched to plurals. And so Revelation 3:20 is a potluck. I will come in with them and eat with them and they with me and and they shifted things to plurals. I mean, to second persons from third. I think they made a lot of mistakes. Amen. So when they were trying, and a lot of people said, well, what's the point? And the point is, English is changing, and if you don't think English is changing, you really do not know what's going on in the English-speaking world. It may not be changing in your context, but it's changing everywhere. Don Carson was famous for saying, if I took the old NIV, Don Carson loves to go into secular schools and debate people. He sets these huge debates up. And he said, if I read an NIV 84, who had a he and a him, I've lost the debate. It's all over. My daughter's PhD student is always telling me the latest third declension pronoun someone's made up. Z. is the next one, Z-H-E, H-E, stupid word. So they did the TNIV, not because they're liberal, not because they're feminist. My goodness, Doug Moo has published profusely on a complementarian position. But there's all kinds of accusations of being liberal and feminist and what, and absolutely none of them are true. Absolutely none of them are true. They believe, and they have the evidence to prove it, because I've seen the evidence that language is changing. Worldwide language. NIV was always written for the world's English. Not Southern English, not Northern English, the world's English. Well, the NIV, the TNIV was just absolutely horrific. I was one of the original signers against it. It was so bad. And what happened in the debate is that people started questioning the translator's motives. You'd never translate, you never question motives. You don't know what they are. In an academic debate, it doesn't matter what the motives are. You got to deal with the facts. And so I'm the only person to get my name off that list of protesters. I would take it off, someone would put it back on. I'd take it off and put it back on. So when Mo Gerkens, the president of Zonovan, said, the NIV is dying, we have to do something, here's what we're going to do. We're going to kill it. We're going to kill the TNIV. And come October 1st, I don't care where the committee is, that's the 2011, we're going to come on the 400th anniversary of the King James. So they invited me in as a, quote, friendly critic, because I'd been 10 years on the ESV. And my introduction to the NIV was 3 weeks locked up in Whistler. If you got to get locked up somewhere, Whistler up in BC is a good place to get locked up. And had to take care of all the gender language. And it was pretty harsh. It was pretty harsh. But we did it, and then that became the 2011. There are people that love the 2011. There are people that hate it. It all depends upon how you handle the word they. And English teachers don't like it. Zonovan spent $250,000 with the Collins Dictionary people, and they asked the question in broad English, where is English going? And it is irrefutable evidence that they is becoming the pronoun of choice. There's no, I've seen the data. It's unassailable. Unassailable.
So you're just saying it's becoming correct
English? It's becoming correct English, just like it was in Shakespeare's day. I use they all the time when I speak. Nobody picks it up. I've used it with you guys, and I doubt you've even picked it up. Now, here's the problem. Written language, spoken language is always ahead of written language. So what we hear when we see it, it can be a little more jarring. But we tend to handle they okay in written text. You get a few places like, anyone who has ears to hear, let them hear. There's the problem. Once you commit to they, you've committed to them. Them's only plural. English has not shifted enough to make them indefinite. And so one of my proposals is I'm going to go back and say, anyone who has ears to hear, let them hear. In English, the only antecedent of them is ears. It can't be anything else grammatically. But that's not what the text means. It's anyone, let anyone hear, right? But because you have ears, plural, you hit the them goes back to ears. And there is no word themselves, although it will be created, I have no doubt. Now, in 10 years, this debate will be gone. I mean, the rate of change in our language with pronouns is astronomical. Maybe down here, it'll definitely be, you all will be the last to change. I mean, all the numbers show that. All the numbers show that. But man, if you want to communicate on a college campus, you go to Atlanta, you want to communicate on a college campus, you better not be saying he, because they will shut you down like that. And it's not good nor bad. The language changes. Would it be nice if the language never changed? Absolutely. Has there ever been a language in the history of the world that hasn't changed? Nope. Not even Chinese. I always thought Chinese was the same for the last 3,000 years. My Chinese friends just laughed at me. He said, oh, you really don't know Chinese at all. It's undergone massive changes. So the problem is that the TNIV was so poorly done, and there was what appeared to be lying and deceit, that it's carried over. The NIV is still the number one Bible in terms of sales. The NLT is really gaining ground, because the NIV kind of plays this uncomfortable role between the ESV and the NLT. NLT is what's called a natural language. They don't care at all how many Greek words there are, whether they're participles or whatever. They're just going to say it like you speak in English. And ESV is, we don't care that much about meaning. We're just going to stick to the right words. And there's value in both. The NIV is in an uncomfortable position. So for us, the question is, can we wait out the evolution in the language? Because guesses are in about 10 years, the language will have fully changed. We'll see. Could be wrong. But so yeah, the TNIV costs Donovan millions and millions and millions of dollars, no doubt. And it was a terrible translation, I think.
Since the ESV claims that following sometimes at least essentially literal,
yeah,
they are trying to take into consideration some of this fact. Maybe not the pronoun fact, but
yeah. Yeah, there's some attempt of that. And in the RSV, there was a lot of times there would be the word man when there is no anthropos in Greek. And we got rid of, actually, I think a couple thousand male-oriented reference in the RSV that weren't reflected in the Greek. So the ESV tried to be sensitive, but it used what's called anaphoric he. It uses he to refer back to something regardless of its gender. Which makes translation much easier. But, I mean, the ESV is designed for people that are willing to study. And the meaning is that if we thought that our translation was going to lead to misunderstanding, we were very quick to interpret. The most interpretive the ESV gets is, those who were born of God do not. ESV says continue in sin. Perfectly legitimate translation of the present tense. But we were concerned enough about perfectionism that we didn't want to say sin and give fuel to that. But other than that, the ESV really tries to go as long as it conveys some meaning, word for word. So anyway, translations is it's an amazing process. It's vastly more intricate than even I, as a Greek professor, ever knew. There's so many things you have to take into consideration. And the fragmentation of the English language right now is very, very difficult. Very difficult. Answer your question?
Yeah. Just follow up though. What would you say to somebody who has such a bad taste in their mouth about the NIV in general because of the TNIV?
Tell them the TNIV was properly killed and buried, and it has no effect on the ongoing work on the NIV. I have never once heard someone say, well, we did this in the TNIV, in terms of gender language. This is what we did in the TNIV, so we really should stick to it. I've been on the committee 4 years now. That's never been an argument. There were a lot of good changes exegetically in the TNIV unrelated to gender language, and most of those have been allowed to stand because they were good changes. There's no push on the committee, because actually the people that pushed really hard, am I being recorded, Matt? Okay. Committees change over time, and I'm very comfortable in the NIV right now. Let me give you an example of how hard translation is. Ehud, okay, who is the judge that stabbed the fat guy? Okay, Ehud did the stabbing, right? Okay. Ehud was the king. Eglon was the king. Ehud was the judge. Okay. Okay, I just said it and I forgot what you said. Eglon is the king, right? You know that Eglon wasn't fat? It is not what the word means. It can't be what the word means. Because you know who also was described with the same Hebrew word? Daniel, vegetarian. The word means a stud. It means a robust man. A man who can handle himself in the fight. Strong. And see, that's really important because the judge didn't kill an obese slob kind of image. He switched sides. He was left-handed, so his sword was on the side they weren't checking. And he went after a warrior, and he rammed him through. Those knives are so long, about a foot and a half came out his back. Now, here's what makes it difficult. One is the tradition. Everyone knows Eglon's fat, right? Everyone knows that. But if you were in that day and age, where if you were rich, would you be skinny? No. I remember going to Hawaii for the first time, and a gal was talking. She was overweight by 20, 30 pounds, and she said, I know I look overweight to you. You know what? I'm just right in our culture. Just right. Americans are fixated on anorexic physiques. But rich Old Testament warrior kings didn't have that fixation. So did he have fat on him? Yes. Here's the hard part. The fat that closed around the sword, it wasn't external fat, it was internal fat. It was his organs that closed around the sword. Now you translate that. That this is one of the more interesting illustrations, but it does show how phenomenally complicated translation work can become. And it's why I enjoy it so much. Okay, you had asked about the Septuagint of Deuteronomy 24:1. It's kind of weird, but here, let me go word for word. But if anyone takes a woman or wife and lives with her, marries her, and it's got a verb here, we're going to ignore it, and if she is not found grace before him, in other words, if she doesn't curry favor in his eyes, is the idea, and he finds in her shameful, unpresentable, indecent, or unmentionable. That's what the word means. An indecent pragma, thing, then the divorce is. So the answer is, the Septuagint is equally vague. Eskimon means, again, it's generally used as something that is not done openly, displayed, or discussed in reserved society because it's considered shameful, unpresentable, indecent, or unmentionable. And it's often used relative to sexual activity. But again, it's a very, very broad term. Okay. Hey, let me go through my last two pages of notes, and it'll be easier. Otherwise, I might be referring to them in the discussion, and then we can talk about stuff. The point historically was to control divorce and a certain kind of remarriage. That's the thrust. Well, the primary thrust was don't get divorced. Number one, it's only if there's some indecency in her. In other words, it is not a no-fault divorce state. All right, I've got a friend who, after a year of marriage, found out his wife is having an affair. He refused to, even though he could divorce her, he refused to. He was not going to end the marriage. And she fought for 5 years to try to get him to divorce her. He absolutely refused to divorce her. She finally moved, I think it was to Missouri, so she could do a no-fault divorce and divorced him. He never signed the papers. Okay. That kind of no-fault divorce is what Deuteronomy and Jesus is concerned about. There has to be an indecency. And as I said, secondly, divorce certificate protects her from unjust charges. Understanding that word in 1 Corinthians 7, that she is not bound, is a legal term that means divorced and eligible for remarriage. In Roman law, if someone was going to get divorced and the husband wanted to say she was this kind of person and therefore nobody should ever marry her, it had to be stipulated in the divorce document. All the documentation for this is in David's book. So when it says not bound, it means she is no longer married and is eligible for remarriage. That is what the legal term means. Very, very important point. And again, yeah, the point that Jesus is making is the solemnity and seriousness of marriage. You cannot move in and out of marriage, which is what actually the Deuteronomy passage is about, right? If you get married, you get divorced, you get married again, you get divorced, you can't go back and marry the first wife. So that actually is what Deuteronomy 24 is about, is prohibiting a certain kind of remarriage. So this was the passage that the Pharisees had to deal with. We talked about that. The translation in the ESV makes her commit adultery. I'm remembering the discussion now. Take a step back. The old translation in the NIV 84 is causes her to become an adulteress. Terrible translation. Why? Because it describes her as living in an ongoing state of adultery. Causes her to become an adulteress. So the ESV, we change it to makes her commit adultery, a single act that is forgivable, not an ongoing state. And then the new NIV change it to being a victim of adultery, trying to get away from the idea that this act moves you into a perpetual, unforgivable state of sin. Because that's not what Jesus is saying. Yeah, the new NIV is anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality makes her the victim of adultery. So we're not, and who was it? Again, it was Quarles quotes Craig Blomberg's commentary at this point. He said, there's a difference between the act of adultery and entering into that and then living in that condition. And he says, this is not the unforgivable sin. And there's a difference between committing adultery, in this case, committing adultery in the remarriage, when you're still in your mind married, in God's eyes, you're married to the first, and then living perpetually in a state of sin. That gal who called me at Gordon Conwell was being told she lives perpetually in a state of sin. And that's, I just don't think that's what the Bible says. Here's the real problem. What? How do we apply the exception clause, right? I mean, we can preach our hearts out about the sanctity of marriage. We can hire counselors to work in our churches to help people make stronger marriages. We can bring in ministries that are really good at helping ministries. I mean, we can do all the positive stuff, but there's going to be divorce. What does that mean? And I am comfortable expanding out as long as it's sexual. I will argue that point strongly. That porneia is any kind of sexual activity that is outside the scope of marriage. Pornography clearly is a sexual activity, right? I mean, that's what's going on in porneia. I'm just looking at dirty pictures. It is a sexual activity. The question then is, what about abuse? Verbal abuse, physical abuse, and whatnot. And my position on that, and I know it's a debatable point, is that the first stage is separation. We have a good friend whose husband has been emotionally abusive for 10 years. He finally had an affair, and his wife is free biblically to divorce him. But the question is, if he hadn't had the affair, would 10 years of abuse constitute a legitimate violation of the marriage covenant? And my counsel at that point was, that's what separation is for. That women are so phenomenally abused. Men are phenomenally henpecked. Women are phenomenally abused. And when it comes to the issue of physical safety, that's what legal separation is all about. And I don't know how you feel about that, but it's one step short of divorce. It prevents the harm, and it jogs the husband into realizing he's now powerless. And I think that has real value. Of saying, okay, I can't. I mean, this man was reading his wife's texts, was reading her emails, was absolutely controlling everything, would not let her go anywhere without him. And I don't know what's going to happen in their marriage, but that's part of the advantage of a separation, that it jogs the husband, he loses power. And he has to look at the situation a little more clearly. So, anyway. So, comments or questions? Difficult issue. When I was struggling with this, I called a very good friend of mine. He's got a PhD in New Testament. Knows Greek a lot better than I do. He's been a constant resource for me. And had gone through a very, very ugly divorce, I was told. And I said, okay, surely if anyone, he would know how to handle the biblical data. So I called him, and I said, okay, how do you handle the exception clause, blah, blah, blah. And he says, oh, Bill, he said, the pain was simply so intense, you don't care. You just want the pain to stop. I said, so there was no sexual infidelity on your wife's part? No. It was just a horrible marriage that was so painful that both of us just wanted the pain to go away. So... you know this, right? I mean, I'm not saying anything you don't know. Comments or questions? I think a straightforward reading is that if you're divorced for non-biblical reasons, you're still married in God's eyes. So when you remarry, you commit adultery. It's the act. That act, again, this is interpretive, that act does, in fact, sever the marriage covenant of the first marriage. And so a second marriage is not living in sin. Needs to deal with what happened, needs to ask forgiveness, and move on.
So if you're still divorced for non-biblical reasons, you're still married in God's eyes?
I think that's what the text is saying. Yeah, it's really hard to put all the verses together, but that's the best I can come up with. God does not care about our paper. And when you do your marriage vows, you're married until there's death or there's sexual infidelity.
God does care about our word.
Yeah.
And when you break covenant, you break your oath, you break your vow, I don't see God pretending that you did not.
Yeah.
When you divorce, you're divorced whether you have a right to or not.
I can't handle the text with that argument, though, because if you get divorced for non-biblical reasons, then marrying a second time is not an act of adultery. And so that's what our passage is saying, right? Marries another, commits adultery. Isn't that what it says? Yeah. And so you've got that has to be handled in how we do this. Well, that's the question. What breaks the marriage covenant? That's why I think it's so fascinating. It's really hard to come up with a really ironclad argument as to what marriage is. Okay, here's the situation. I worked my way through school taking wedding pictures. And I was taking pictures in the church, and we were downstairs afterwards during the reception. And the pastor came down and said, will you come up and take a picture for me? I went, okay. He said, yeah, there's a couple upstairs getting married and they want a picture. This is in Bowling Green. I said, okay. So I went upstairs and it was a young couple. She was pregnant. They were, they had to be 16. And the pastor explained, she just told her folks that she's pregnant. Her daddy went and bought a shotgun and is looking to kill him. And they figure if they're married, he won't kill his son-in-law. And they needed a picture to prove that they're married. Okay. Were those two married? I mean, if you go to Africa and go through a wedding ceremony, it's a village event, right? It goes for a whole week. There's a giant party. And at the end of the party, you're married. Now, they would look at that ceremony and go, of course you're not married. Well, because you said a couple things? That doesn't make you married. And we look at the other ceremony and go, wait a minute, where's the saying? I mean, where's the vow or whatever?
Ask your kids, you told them to get married. Yeah. Shotgun means there's a wedding involved.
Shotgun means, yes. Yeah. I think it's the vow. I think the vow is what creates the marriage covenant. The sex is certainly the sign of the oath. But if you went through a ceremony, said your vows, and you were driving to Virginia Beach or wherever for your honeymoon, and you got in a car accident and killed, would you die married? Yeah, I would say they were married. So for me, it's the oath.
I would say it's the oath because when Jesus was talking to the lady, he said, "You had five husbands. One of you would now is not your husband."
So she called the first five. He called the first five husbands.
If it were sexual, I would assume she was having a sexual relationship with the one she was.
Yeah, she definitely was having sex with the next man, but she wasn't married to him. I'm sure Hugenberger would have an answer to that, but I don't know what it would be.
I have a difficult time today when people, I mean, it's almost like people come through marriages in churches and custom departments.
Yeah.
And they really say, I've led the further notes.
Yeah. until further notice.
You know, the question is, I've never asked the question you asked, but it is the question. Always ask what that says.
Yeah.
And all 90% of them have.
Yeah.
And I've asked myself time again,
Yeah.
There is, in South America, of course, there is a civil ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
That's illegal.
Yeah.
And there's a religious ceremony. If you aren't religious, you don't need it.
Yeah.
Your son is done that. I had a couple who wanted me to perform a wedding without me. God. That's what I don't do in the book, just literally justice.
Right, right. Yeah.
Today's culture is really confused.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Our culture is very, very confused with marriage. But that's what happens when you kick God out. When I was listening on BT, Biblical Trading, when Bruce was doing the class on Proverbs, he made a fascinating point. He goes, until you have universal knowledge, you cannot have absolute knowledge. That there is no absolute knowledge unless you know everything. And of course, the only person who knows everything is God. That's what's wrong with us saying, well, here are two men, they love each other, they should be able to get married. They don't have complete knowledge. And therefore, they can't have absolute knowledge, saying it's okay. Only God has absolute knowledge. Therefore, only God can state absolute knowledge. And, you know, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the garden, that's what this is, right? It's God who decides what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. That's his call. And the reason he can do that is he has absolute knowledge. He sees the whole picture. And therefore, we have to submit to his statements, his authority, because we simply don't know enough to counter him. But in this day and age, that doesn't mean anything. Yeah.
I'm not even talking about homosexuality in this question. But marriage is a man and a woman for a reason. Now we want to redefine it.
Yeah.
No, we don't.
Some people do.
Some people do.
The culture is redefining marriage.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's that easy.
Yeah. You know, part of me thinks if a man and a man, or a woman or a man and two women, you know these arguments, right? If the gay movement is okay, then why limit it to two? Why not three? Why not a boy? Why not a dog? I mean, once you throw out universal knowledge, you can have no absolute knowledge, and therefore, everything's wide open. Yeah. So what do you think on the divorce? What do you think about this? How wide are you comfortable going with a thing of indecency?
I think the idea of ambidextrous.
Of what?
Ambidextrous.
I don't.
Isn't that what we're talking about before?
Oh.
That could be one of them.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. It took me a second. Yeah, that really wasn't.
Okay, now I don't want to be on tape.
Too late. He said yes, that's on tape. Yeah, I mean, I keep thinking, I don't think most men understand the violence against women. I mean, I didn't until I had a daughter. And Kirsten's made me very sensitive to this. She went to a phenomenally liberal school, University of Oregon. My goodness. She came home talking about male-bodied and female-bodied people. Claimed she had been taught that 1 out of 12 people's chromosomes are mixed up and they're in their wrong body. I went, oh, please. So I called a doctor friend of mine and said, yeah, genetic abnormalities are 1 out of 147,000. And that is including people where there's no gender confusion. So I told her, Kirsten, she goes, oh, I got snookered, didn't I? I go, yeah, you did. But you know, it's just what's being taught in the... California, right? If you're a first grade boy, if you decide you're a girl, you can go in the girls' bathroom. Thank you, Jerry Brown. And you're all rushing to California, aren't you? I'm from California, so that's... Pardon?
Which bathroom does he use?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, which one does he use? Yeah. It is this whole... Call it gender confusion isn't fair. This is... Anything that God establishes in creation, sin wants to destroy. I remember I was preaching once, and I was on like on a Friday, and this car drove by, and it gave me the perfect illustration for Sunday, because the bumper sticker said, "Rats have rights." You know that's the law, and I believe, where's Phoenix? Arizona. I've been told, to be fair, I've been told that legislation, and really weird in Arizona of all places, where you could shoot them, but they still have rights. But when you find a rat, it has rights, and that means you got to get it out of the house or something like that. When I asked the people on Sunday, I said, do rats have rights? Well, of course not. I said, why? It was remarkable. Most people don't know why rats don't have rights. Pardon? Oh, bats do, yeah.
Try to get bats out of a building. Depending on what type they are, you can't just exterminate
them. Yeah. We...
Seriously.
You don't know? I know, I know. We
have that in our house.
We had a... The joke was we had an empty lot across from us, and it gave us a great view of the whole Columbia Valley. We knew eventually they were going to... build a house there. So I thought about going and finding some rare salamander and letting it loose. Because then they couldn't build there because, you know, there were some. Rats don't have human rights because they were not created in the image of God. They're not created the apex of creation. And whether you accept that or not, at least I have a reason for why rats don't have rights. Now, should rats be treated well? Yeah, they're part of God's creation, and we were put here to take care of creation. And that includes rats and salamanders. You know, it does. But they're not the same as you and me. But see, I think what the world is doing is it's trying to go against Genesis and trying to eradicate the difference of us being created in the image of God. And so it's trying to put everything on the same plane. So on one hand, rats have rights. On the other hand, unborn children don't have any rights. And so there's this, well, we're all just animals. In fact, I was shocked to hear it. The guy used to do the silly commentaries at the end of 60 Minutes.
Andy Rooney,
thank you. Andy Rooney was talking something about some statistics that come out about sexual activity. And I was just shocked. He goes, I mean, you can't possibly expect men and women to have sexual controls. I mean, we're just animals. I went, well, okay. He doesn't believe in the image of God. I do. So I think that's the attack, is to remove all of the distinctions that God created in Genesis. Because after all theology comes out of Genesis 1, 2, and 3, right? Ultimately, everything goes back there. Everything. Every major thing, anyway. See, Matt, I changed my mind on that. Who was the teacher at Gordon Conwell that was making that, the Old Testament prof? He left before I got there. Do you remember? He argued that what you had in Genesis 1, 2, and 3 was a temple. Yeah, Beale would have picked up. There's a note to, Klein. Meredith Klein's argument was that. Yeah, that Genesis 1, 2, and 3 is a temple, and this is how we were created to live and to relate and to worship. And that temple was destroyed. And so that means it's amazing how many times theology goes back to that. So as one guy says, what was Jerry Falwell's comment? God didn't make Adam and Steve. Made Adam and Eve.
I'm kind of wondering, though, on this divorce thing. I believe in Scripture. Stratify our viewing. In other words, you have core
far greater expectations that I place greater burdens on when it comes to marriage. But you're going to get a lot of people who come to you that were married who had no concept of covenant, no concept of our understanding of marriage. And it, right now, I mean, it is virtually a contract in the general populace, and even among most, a lot of Christians, it's still a contract. I'm kind of wondering if it's really difficult to try to expect everybody to live up to the same standard. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So the difficulty is, can't we be free to deal with ad hoc basis without being bound absolutely by thou shalt, this is, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and my answer, the question is, do we have to treat everyone exactly the same? And the answer is absolutely not. And like in my position paper on divorce, it made a big distinction whether the person was married, was a Christian or not when the divorce happened. My general approach to ethics is that life is a journey. And you treat people differently where they are on the journey. For some people, not using the Lord's name in vain is about, that's the most they can work on. And that's all, you know, and they may be saying all kinds of things that, you know, would not be acceptable in church. But, you know, If they can get through the day without saying GD, they are as happy as any Christian could possibly be. We're all on different places on the journey. And it doesn't mean the standards change. It means we're just on different places on the journey. That's how I would approach it. If I were dealing with someone who had been a Christian for 60 years and got divorced, I would probably treat them a little differently than if it was an 18-year-old... that had gotten married because got his girlfriend pregnant. I just did the most interesting wedding of my life, by the way. I've never done a wedding with a 6-month-old baby in the front row. It was really different. You ever done that? Their baby was in the front row. Baby was six months old. They were not quite of marriageable age. And it was a fascinating situation. And a very good friend of mine was their counselor. And so I knew they were getting good counsel. They weren't getting married just because they had a baby. And I got to spend some time with them. And I know the bigger story really well. So I agreed to do the wedding. And it was, everyone knows they had sex. Because the baby's right there. So I just wove the baby into the story. And I didn't talk about walking backwards into the wedding, but yeah, I almost did. But we talked about the extra challenges there were going to be and what it was really going to mean for the husband to sacrificially love his wife and baby when he was barely out of high school and had all kinds of dreams of going to college, but I don't know if he was going to go to college. He has other things to do. I mean, so it's kind of like I treated them radically differently than I would treat someone older. So yeah, but life is a journey. We're all on the difficult path. Some people fall off the path in different places. We all fall off the path in different places. And it doesn't mean the standards change, though. What?
We used to have a lot of cultural, social support for the person to
be born. Right.
So a lot of the problems, well, not problems, because of society now, zero.
Yeah, but there's very little common grace of God's left in our culture, but so it just makes it harder. But you don't shift standards, but you know, there but for the grace of God go I. Frankly, you know. Yeah, you have obviously haven't had that issue come up yet in your life. It was fascinating. Because I had to know if they were repentant. But, I mean, they loved the little girl. The parents loved their first grandchild. And, you know, so you can't say, you know, are you sorry you ever, you know, you, I mean, it just, it didn't fit the situation. But They knew what they had done was wrong. She had not compounded it by aborting the baby, even though there had been a lot of pressure from some people to kill the child. So there was a lot of good mixed in with the bad. It was just a very interesting... Turned out to be, it was a great wedding. It was an encouragement. We'll see what happens. I thought you guys would want to talk a lot more about this. Yeah, if you could. All right, it's okay. I've got stuff to cover anyway. Let me look at my notes here just a second. Remember some. Yeah. Adultery is not the unforgivable sin, any more than ongoing greed and gossip are the unforgivable sin. I had, every once in a while, I'd say things that, and I knew I was going to make the church frustrated with me. My normal line was, you know, this problem would go away if we'd just be persecuted. And most people didn't really like it when I said that. But, I forgot where I was going now. I said, we were talking, I don't know what we're talking about, but I said, you know, we so stratify sins that there are those that are acceptable. Those are the ones that I commit. And then there are ones that are not acceptable. That's what you commit. And so instead of loving you, I'm going to judge you. That's how the church functions often. And I said, if I were given the choice of having a church and preaching to a group of gay and divorced people or a group of gossips, I'll take the gay and divorced people in a second. And you ought to have seen the looks on their faces. They simply couldn't process it because they had made homosexuality and adultery the remaining two sins, really the only two sins. And they couldn't conceive of why I would think gossip was that bad. And I said, have you ever seen a church torn apart by the homosexual movement or adultery? Well, we've heard of stories, but have you ever seen it? None of them had. I said, ever been in a church torn apart? Have you ever seen God's body torn apart by gossip? I have. Much rather preach to people who know who they are in Christ as forgiven sinners than religious Pharisees who think they're better because they're okay with their sins. That's a non-issue for me. Non-issue. Okay, let's take a 5 or 6 minute break, which means 10, and we'll look at these last three things in chapter 5. If they're not, I got the elders. Anything you can do to help. Well, you broke me of my bias towards Priuses, so you know maybe there's something else. Anyway, no, let's go through. It'll be good. You running, Matthew? Yeah. Okay, we are on to the third of the five examples of deep obedience, and my label on this one is rigorous honesty. I don't know where I got the phrase from, but I really, really like it. Verse 33. Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you made. Okay? But I tell you, don't swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it's God's throne, or by earth, for it's the footstool, his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. All you need to say is simply yes, no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. Again, I thought that Coral's explanation of the ways, again, it's an entire tractate in the Mishnah, of all the ways that you could take an oath and not have to fulfill it was fascinating. And it was, again, it was kind of like the divorce passage where it was like when it was done, I say, God, why don't you just kill us all? I mean, how can you have the patience to put up with people? I mean, it's really amazing that you know, these are God's people, chosen people, the chosen nation, and they're just elaborately trying to find a way to lie. And it was an amazing, I think he did a really, really good job. Jesus is not quoting any one specific Old Testament passage, but it is certainly the basic teaching of the Old Testament law. So what you have is not a prohibition against oaths in the Old Testament, but you have a requirement to fulfill your oaths. And what do the Pharisees do? They start narrowing. Well, if we swear by Jerusalem, we don't have to keep it. But if we swear facing Jerusalem, we have to, because that's the city of God, that's the city of the great king. And if it's about God, then we have to keep it. But if we could, you know, if we can cross our fingers and swear by Jerusalem, I don't have to keep my word. And so it was just this elaborate way to be able to lie and get away. But see what they're doing, they're narrowing it. And Jesus does, and basically the way the Pharisees work, if the introductory formula used God's name or in some way made a direct reference to him, you had to keep your promise. But if somehow it didn't directly affect God, then you don't have to keep your word. So Jesus says, well, what does it matter? If you swear by heaven, that's God's. If you swear by earth, that's his footstool. If you swear by Jerusalem, that's the city of the great king, the Messiah. It's all God's. It's all God's. So you can't mince your oath based on your wording. God, we do the same thing, right? Today, we tell little white lies. They're neither white nor little. They're lies. We're purposely ambiguous, leaving ourselves loopholes. Or we spin, if you're a politician or anyone else. You want to blur the edges so you can get away with not being held to what you say. You exaggerate. You make yourself better than you really are. Or we use words like, I just devastated me. Really? Devastated? I mean, you may not liked it. It may have bugged you, but devastate you? See, these are all ways of fudging and blurring the edges so that we don't have to be rigorously honest. So Jesus goes to the spirit of the law, and he says, look, when you say yes, mean it. When you say no, mean it. Stott's line was great. When a monosyllable will do, why waste our breath by adding to it? Two stories. I have a very, very pretty sister, and everybody wanted to date my sister in high school. And she and mom and she developed this little routine. A guy would call, and mom would find out who it was. Communicate that to Terry, you know, by saying his name. If she was interested in going on a date, she took the phone. If she was not interested in the date, she went out the back door. Mom would wait, and she'd say, she's not here right now. She's not, right? She's on the back step, but she didn't bother to tell the guy that. One night at dinner, just out of the blue, my dad says, I wonder if a lie is saying something that's not true or giving the impression of something that's not true. And went back to eating his mashed potatoes. But mom and Terry got the message very clearly. And they weren't being rigorously honest. Terry was doing it so she wouldn't hurt the guy's feelings. Not being rigorously honest. Do you know the story of Ray Kroc and McDonald's when it comes to honesty? This is a fabulous story, and it's true. I had a friend who lived two doors up from me. He used to be one of the administrators at Azusa Pacific. He left Azusa to go work for the company that makes all the bread, you know, buns and whatnot, for McDonald's in the five-state area, including California. So it's a pretty big bakery. And this was before McDonald's had moved into Europe. And they asked the bakery people to come in, so Tim went in with them. And he was the one who told me this story. And they talked about the desire to expand into Europe. McDonald's was concerned about consistency of quality. And so they wanted this bakery to go to someplace in the middle Europe and spend $5 million and open up a bakery for all the McDonald's that were coming to Europe. The interesting thing about Ray Kroc is that he never signed a contract in his life. He absolutely refused. His word was his bond. They talked about it, came to clarity, they shook hands, and Tim's company went out and spent $5 million. Back when $5 million was really something. All because they knew that Ray Kroc's word was more binding than any contract could possibly be. See, that's rigorous honesty, isn't it? Kroc was famous for loyalty. If he was working with a supplier and, you know, the sausage or something was not up to par, they wouldn't just dump him because he had made a commitment to work with them. So McDonald's would send their people to the sausage factory and they would whip the sausage factory into shape. They would find the problems. They would fix the supply chain issues. Whatever it took, when Ray said he was going to work with Ray, I don't know him. When Mr. Kroc said that they were going to work with a supplier, they worked with a supplier because his word was his bond. Rigorous honesty. And I think that's what Jesus is getting at. That's the kind of people we should be. And you know, when you meet some, say, no, I promise. What are they saying? Yeah, I know you don't normally trust me, but really this time you can. How much better to say, yes. Yes, I'll do that. You know, is there ever a time to take an oath? Well, there are certain times people that say no. Anabaptists, Moravians, Jehovah's Witness, and Quakers. Do Quakers still hold this position? Where's Frank when we need him? The cause of all problems in our life, Frank. Do Quakers still hold this position?
In North Carolina, you can affirm.
Okay, you can affirm. What does that mean? You're not saying, I swear to God, but you can affirm, yes, this is what I promised to do, kind of thing. Okay. These group of people historically won't take a courtroom oath. They won't sign an affidavit, and they won't say the Pledge of Allegiance against history. Again, where's Quakers on this today? Well, nobody says Pledge of Allegiance. I saw Jesse Waters' World the other night as he was going around, kind of like what Jay Leno used to do, the man on the street. Asking people to say, do they know the Pledge of Allegiance? I don't think he found anyone that knew the Pledge of Allegiance. It was really amazing. But will Quakers say the Pledge of Allegiance, or is that still a no-no?
I don't remember.
Okay. All right. Anyway, there are people that say, no, that's what Jesus says, and so we're not going to take an oath. My position is that I want to give a qualified yes. I think there are times that oath-taking is okay. Part of it has to do with the language of the Sermon on the Mount, just as I don't cut off my hands and gouge out my eyes. I understand that Jesus is speaking to a culture that is a lying, deceiving culture. And he's trying to make a point. Look, just be honest people. Don't cross your fingers on everything. But God takes oaths. He took them never to destroy the world again after the flood. He sealed the covenants of promise, right? He sealed his promise to Abraham by putting him to sleep and walking between the slain animals. Paul calls God as a witness, which in essence is an oath. But I think what the application that we can all agree on is that We should not be the kind of people where we have to take an oath. We should be rigorously honest. We should be known to be absolute honest. And that when Dave says yes, he doesn't mean maybe. He means yes. And he's simply that kind of person. There may be times in which you want to affirm, to use that language. I took an oath 32 years ago to love and cherish Robin above all else. Marriage is an oath. It's an establishment of a covenant. So I vowed, I promised, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But the thrust of it that is applicable to all is that, are we so rigorously honest that all we have to do is say is yes or no, and people will take us at our word? I think that's what's going on here. Yeah. Yeah, to tell the truth, as opposed to what you just said. So rigorous honesty. Be wonderful. If you imagine, the number one charge against the church is that we're hypocrites. Imagine if the church really were truly rigorously honest, how that would go away. The world would find something else to grouse about, but at least we could get rid of that. Okay, so we move. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That, good point. Good point. Yeah. Situational ethics is one of those terms that have probably been created by the opponents, and you never want to let someone else define your position. Yeah, Corey. Yeah. Corey Ten Boom. This is the difference between Corey Ten Boom and her sister. She decided that she would lie. Her sister said that she wouldn't lie. I think the answer is we all have a hierarchy of ethics. Among other things, a wife is told that she should have a submissive spirit to her husband. Okay, but when the husband asks her to lie on taxes, she should say no. Not because she's being rebellious, but because we have a hierarchy of ethics, and God's told us to be honest. And so we all have these hierarchies, don't we? And so that's the formal way to deal with that issue. I don't know if I've ever been in a situation. Yeah, there's one situation in which I always lie. And that's when I buy my wife a present. I've asked for permission to lie through my teeth when it comes to Christmas. Because my wife can just intuit things. So I always buy her a Christmas present in June and then hide it. So I don't know. I mean, what would be some other situations in which if you were trying to protect an abused person against an attacker, that's a higher ethic, and we need to protect the vulnerable. Yeah, if this dress makes me look fat, because your hierarchy says permanence of marriage, you say no.
No, you say, do you think I'm stupid?
Do you think I'm stupid? No, I would just lie.
Why are you going to offer sacrifice? What are you going to do when you go up toward Jesse's house? I told Samuel, who was concerned about the consequences.
Yeah.
You take a heifer along, and if anybody asks, you say that you're going up to offer sacrifice.
Well, that means he didn't tell the whole truth.
We are not obligated to tell the whole truth under all circumstances. In my judgment, at least God didn't think that Samuel was obligated to tell the whole truth.
Yeah, as long as Samuel is doing what God told him to do. You know, there's an example. Jesus is going to the home, the girl has died, everyone's wailing, and they say to him, he says, she's just sleeping. And they go, no. He goes and he raises her from the dead. Now, did Jesus just lie? I always thought that he did. And then I realized there actually was a much more fundamental theological truth at work. That Jesus doesn't view death like you and I do. And that she was, at a very significant theological level, she was sleeping. She was sleeping in death, but she was sleeping and he was going to go wake her up. At a very significant level, he didn't lie at all. Now, yes, he didn't want the people to know he'd raised her from the dead because it would make preaching almost impossible. But it was interesting how he said it, I thought.
Rahab hid the spies.
Yeah, Rahab hid the spies. Yeah. We all have situational ethics. And I've only met one person that insists that he doesn't and he would never lie under any circumstance, not to save his wife from being killed or anything. And I just think that given the situation, he would lie through his teeth because he's a good person. Anyway, okay. Next one, the whole issue of Christian rights. 5:38-42. You have heard that it was said... I forgot to point out. Notice what Jesus is doing. He's dealing with the Pharisaical interpretation, but where the Old Testament says oaths are okay as long as you keep them, he says, just don't do it. And this is one of those indications that Jesus sees himself as supreme over the Old Testament. Not just to give it the right interpretation, but potentially to overrule it. So he doesn't say, keep your oaths. He says, yes, I know the Old Testament says you can take oaths. Just don't do it. Supremacy of Christ. Yeah, that'd be another example. Yeah, another example. Yeah. Good. Again, you have heard it said to the people long ago, You have heard the same thing. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Lex talionis is the technical term. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. Well, what does that mean? Well, let me give you four illustrations. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, that's the translation here is backwards. Take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, the inner garment, hand over your coat, the outer garment as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. This is the reflection of one of the oldest laws in the world, Lex Talionis, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. And its original intention was to limit the escalation of retaliation. In other words, somebody takes out my eye, the only thing I can do is take out their eye. Someone takes out my tooth, I can't take out two of their teeth. I only can take out one of their teeth. So it was the original intention was to limit escalation. It's in Deuteronomy 19:21. The interesting thing in the Old Testament, it's the prerogative of the judges. This was not an individual prerogative. This is what governed the judges doing their job in order to maintain order of society. And again, it was restrictive. It was to break the cycle of increasing retaliation. Then along come the Pharisees, and what do? They want to change the intention of the law, and they move it from the realm of the state to the realm of the individual. I have my rights. And they removed it from being restrictive, no more than a tooth, to prescriptive, that I have a right to take your tooth, and I'm going to take your tooth. It was never intended to be obligatory, as far as I know. Now, again, Quarles has a slightly different view on this, but my understanding, it was never intended to be obligatory, always to be restrictive. And in understanding this passage, I'd say the only way I know to make sense of this passage is to understand it in light of the next passage, because in the next passage, it's love your enemies. And I don't know what to do with this paragraph, verses 8:38-42, unless you bring in the concept of love. So I think Jesus knew where he was going in the discussion, because it is love that gives, helps us know how to put this paragraph into play. I think what Jesus is saying is that we must be willing to voluntarily limit our rights when it is an act of love. That's the next paragraph. When it is an act of love for the other person. Now again, love isn't in this paragraph, but it's the only way I can make sense of this. Eye for eye, tooth for the tooth. But I tell you, don't resist an evil person. Well, when don't I resist an evil person? Was my daughter wrong to beat off the attacker? Absolutely not. She had every right to beat him to a bloody pulp. She didn't break through. That's not what's going on in this. It can't be what's going on in the scripture, in this passage. And so my way of reading it is that, how do I know when to do this and when not to do it? When is it an act of love? And I know I'm reading in love for the next paragraph. But so there's four illustrations of resisting an evil person. The first one, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other also. Now, I disagree with Quarles on this point, because he emphasizes that this is the possibility of being hurt badly. All right? And he's right. The word that is used here is used for beating with rods. I understand that. But the key to it is the right cheek. Now, you never use your left hand, ever. Your left hand's for toiletry purposes, nothing else. So you just, why do we shake with our right hand? Yeah, because this belongs in the bathroom and nowhere else. So everything's done with the right hand. And so how do you slap a person on the right cheek? It's a backhand slap. So he's not talking about physical abuse. He's talking about an insult. All right? He's not talking about a punch to the nose. The only way I can get at Dave's right cheek with my right hand is to do that. So he's talking about more an insult than physical pain. Yes.
That also goes back to the point from my idea earlier. You wouldn't expect him to be attacked by a
person. Yeah, this is why he was able to stab Eglon. Because you pull the right sword off your left side. He's left-handed, so his sword's over here. They're checking the wrong side. So that's how he got through the metal detector. Wrong side, left hand. That's why left-handed was viewed as a curse for years and years and years. That's why David had an army, and one of the whole battalions, whatever the word is, was of left-handed slingers. It was so unusual. I used to tease my little brother, who's left-handed, all the time, but he stopped thinking it was funny, so I stopped teasing him. What does this not mean? This is not an ethic for non-Christian society. Non-Christian society is utterly incapable of turning the other cheek as a society. It's the sermon's for disciples. It's not for society. It's not discussing the role of the state. I don't think you can use this as a proof text for pacifism. The King James translation is really unfortunate. It says, "Do not resist evil." Well, we are to resist evil. This is the evil person. And so the question is, when do we resist the evil person? When do we, when they insult us by slapping us on the cheek, do we turn the other also? And I think it's when there's an act of love. But at a minimum, this passage is saying we must be willing to lay aside our personal rights if doing so would be an act of love. This is Bonhoeffer's famous line in The Cost of Discipleship. The gospel bids you come and die. You die to your rights. You die to your rights. Of course, does this mean we have to accept any form of physical or emotional abuse? Does that mean we don't protect ourselves? Of course not. The state exists to punish abuse. There are times where Paul insists on his rights. Right? The Philippians come in Acts 16 and say, okay, we decided you can leave. And he goes, oh, really? Roman citizen, you imprison a Roman citizen without a trial, that would be a capital punishment. I'm not going anywhere. And he made the leaders give him a ticket tape parade basically out of the city to protect the fledgling church. Yeah, Paul insisted on his right. God's going to strike you, you whitewash wall. Paul was not wrong to say that. It was wrong to say that to the high priest. But again, we have examples of people, of Paul in this case, insisting on his rights for whatever be the purpose. Turn the other cheek is an illustration of a principle. It's the principle of non-retaliation. When do we not retaliate? I think it's when it is an act of love. The story I tell is, I wish I had heard the Fuller professor tell this story, but this was back in the 60s, and he was somewhere down here, somewhere in the, at least in the deep south, he told the story. This is before integration, still black and white churches. I don't know your experience. We moved to Kentucky in 67. There's still black and white bathrooms, black and white water fountains. So I don't know, you know, what it was like down here. But he was a kind of a revolutionary young pastor, idealist young pastor at some small church down here in the south somewhere. And he invited a black to church, an African-American to church, way before you could ever do that. And next Sunday morning, in the right when he got up to preach, the back doors was flung open to the church, and a huge, very drunk white man came storming in the back of the church, screaming and yelling at the pastor about bringing an African-American. I'm sure that's not what he was saying, but bringing an African-American into this white church. And it was obvious he was going to storm and beat up the pastor. And the pastor sat there, and he said he was thinking about, this pastor was the professor at Fuller that told the story. And he was sitting there thinking about, what do I do? What do I do? Do I turn the other cheek? Do I not turn the other cheek? And his decision at that point in time was simply to drop his hands, and the guy just beat him to a bloody pulp. Just beat the living daylights out. The irony in the story is that the pastor was a two-time Golden Gloves boxing champ. He didn't have to let the guy touch him. I mean, he could have just annihilated the drunk. But he said in this, and he said, I'm not saying you should do this all the time, but for me, in this situation, in this time, with the beginnings of the civil unrest, with the need for church to take a lead, it was an act of love. And so I dropped my hands, and I got beat up for it. That's what this turn the other cheek business is about, I think. And we, our response, especially physically, is to insist on our rights and to protect and to retaliate. But we have to be willing to not retaliate. And I don't think that, I think these moments come, and there's no way to prepare for them, and you just say, Spirit, tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. But this was his choice. Powerful story, I thought. Turn the other cheek. Second illustration of deep obedience. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. The shirt is the inner garment. The coat is the outer garment that kept you warm at night. It was considered so fundamental to life that even Jewish law made it an inalienable right. You could sue a man or a person for everything except his outer coat. No law would allow you to take the outer coat. And Jesus is saying, don't resist the evil person. And that means they sue you, take your shirt. And they take your shirt, give your coat as well. Now, there's no way that Jesus would expect someone to simply take all of his clothes and run around naked. That's not what's going on, right? Yeah, unless you're San Francisco, okay. What is Jesus not saying? Well, he's not saying leave the law cord and only a loincloth. It's not saying always ignore our legal protection. The question is, are you willing to forgo your rights as an act of love, even if this means suffering loss of property? Third illustration, verse 41. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. This is most likely a reflection of a Persian law that was adopted by the Romans, which is basically a form of conscription. It's what happened to Cyrus. The guy who carried the cross. Simon of Cyrene, thank you. The guy who carried the cross. Is that a Roman soldier could force you to carry a pack 1 mile. You could take your horse and use it for a mile. There was a limit on what they could do, but they had a right to do it. And that's probably the background to it. And he's saying, are you willing to go 2 miles for the hated Roman soldier who's making you carry this phenomenally heavy pack? Well, I would say, is it an act of love? What is Jesus not saying? He's not saying, I'm going to go the extra mile, but not 1 inch further. I have my rights. You know, kind of the old joke about turning the other cheek. Okay, hit me on the cheek, turn, hit me on the cheek. Now I can beat the living daylights out of you because I only got 2 cheeks. You know, they're not saying go the second mile and not an inch further. They're saying, are you willing to forgo your rights as an act of love, even if this means suffering physical pain and the loss of dignity and time? Are you willing to do that? Are you willing to do that? Fourth illustration, the final illustration of deep obedience. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. I'm sorry. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. There's a whole set of laws about loaning money to people, to other Jews without, you know, usury was illegal, you know. Charging interest was illegal. A Jew could not charge interest on a loan to another Jew. And it doesn't mean they obeyed it, but the law is that way. And there's this saying, you know, if somebody needs to borrow money, and probably what it means that was desperate, you need to be willing to loan to them. What is Jesus not saying? He's not saying we should give our money away indiscriminately. He's saying, are you willing to forgo your rights as an act of love, even if this means letting go of your money? Will you hold on to your money so loosely that it easily falls through your fingers as an act of love? Or do you clench your fists so tightly that no one could squeeze a dime out of them? And it's interesting, the somewhat parallel in Luke 6:35 talks about lending money to your enemies. So the whole point of this is lex talionis. Jesus is saying, in terms of an individual ethic, that if it is an act of love, we must be willing to forego our rights if it's an act of love. Very un-American. Very un-American. I'm sorry, I'm getting my illustrations all confused. I heard in the news the other day about a politician's daughter who's suing someone for $5 million because she sprained her ankle.
That's not a politician. That's our.
Yeah, well, I'm referring to the dad. Yeah, well, yeah, that's a totally different issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of person thinks a swollen ankle is worth $5 million? It's just we live in an age of rights and entitlement, don't we? We think we have rights. I mean, you listen to some of these things about the $1 trillion in university debt, and people are so upset that they have to pay it back. I shouldn't have to pay it back. Really? Well, you signed a contract. You took the money. You spent the money. That was your call. We live in such a day and age of entitlement and rights, and we live in such a culture of ungrace, don't we? There's just so little, if any, grace around us. Because when you see it, it startles you. It was really, it went to, where did we go this morning, Matt? Biscuitville. And I had my glasses on, so I couldn't read the receipt. I was trying to find my number, and the guy next to me went, "Oh, let me help you. Oh, you're number 43. Now, where I come from, that would never happen. And I know that's part of Southern hospitality, and I've been missing it. But it was, that was an act of grace. But the interesting thing is, it shocked me. Because the guy came over, I kind of jumped, like, what are you doing? And he was, "Oh, you're 43. I'm not used to people treating me with grace." And that's the world, we, for the most part, we live in. Okay, so lex talionis, non-retaliation. Let's go to the last thing. We got a little bit of time left. We can finish. This is a hard one. And again, the loving your enemies stuff, it's, if you start here, you'll fail every time, right? The only way to begin to learn about loving your enemies is to go back to spiritual depravity, isn't it? And when you realize that God loved you even though you had nothing to offer Him, and you realize that God made peace even though at that time you it was something foreign to you and you didn't have the ability to create peace. And when you go back to the beginning of the golden chain and you see who you are and who God is and how God behaves, that's the path to loving your enemies. There's no other way to get there, is there? And I don't know of anyone that can just force themselves to love their enemies. Can't happen. So this is the end of a very long process throughout chapter 5. Jesus has been pushing toward this paragraph since the first beatitude. To whatever extent our lives reflect the prior verses, to that same extent we'll be able to love our enemies. Loving our enemies flows out of poverty of spirit, mourning over our sin, so forth and so on. I love this quote from Augustine. It was in Stott. He goes, "Many have learned how to offer the other cheek, but do not know how to love him by whom they were struck." That's really hard, isn't it? Probably if we didn't retaliate, we'd feel pretty good about ourselves. But that's not what's required of us. What's required of us is then we have to love that person. We have to love those elders that fought to have you fired. We have to love the people that make our lives miserable. Or do you want me just to skip this paragraph entirely? No. All right. "But you have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy." Okay, here's the clearest example that we're not dealing with the Bible. We're dealing with the Pharisees' interpretation. The Bible says, love your neighbor. And in fact, a few verses later says, oh, by the way, that means loving your enemies. So they, in this case, the Pharisees went flat out at contrary to the teaching of Scripture. "You have heard said from your rabbis, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, you love your enemies. And that means you're going to pray for those who persecute you. Why would you do that? Well, that makes you children or sons of your Father in heaven." In other words, this is what your dad does. Your dad loves his enemies. And as you love your enemies, you are becoming like your dad. Your father. Look at how he treats people. He causes the sun to rise on the evil and on the good. He sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. I mean, this is how he does things. There is a level at which he loves all people and treats them well. He goes, if you love those who love you, what reward do you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? In other words, if you love those that are easy to love, big deal. That doesn't mean anything. "And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Don't even pagans do that?" Of course they do. And then the culmination, not only this paragraph, but I'm going to go and argue for 48 becoming a new paragraph. I don't know if I'll get it in the NIV. But I'm going to argue that I think 48 is not just the culmination to this last example of exceeding righteousness. I think it's the culmination of the whole thing. that we're called to be perfect, mature, complete, just like our Heavenly Father is mature and complete. Again, what did the Pharisees do? They have this command in Leviticus to love your enemy. And they started narrowing the command. And so who's the neighbor? Well, the neighbor's just Jews. It's okay to hate the Gentiles. It's okay to hate the Greeks. It's okay to hate everyone else. We just have to love fellow Jews. And that's not at all what the text is saying. There is something we hate, and that's evil, right? You've got all the imprecatory Psalms that we are called to hate evil. We are not called to hate our enemies. Interesting, we don't have time to get into this, but you know, it's really common to hear the old adage, God loves the sinner, hates the sin. What's the problem with that? Yeah, it's really hard to separate them. It's not what the Bible says. Right? In the precatory Psalms, God clearly hates the sinner. Clearly hates the sinner. And again, I went to Gary Brashears at Western one day and I said, we were talking about love the sin. I love the sinner, hate the sin. And he goes, ah, that's too easy. God hates both. How does that work? And he goes, only God has perfect love and perfect hatred. And he is able to hate the sin and hate the sinner and at the same time love the sinner and die for him. I just kind of throw that out, something to think about as we try to learn what it is to love our enemies. Yeah, the parallel in Luke really makes this point. But I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. What's your definition of love? Very important word. It's a very hard word, I think, to define. This is what God calls it. This is the primary commandment, right? Love God, love our neighbor. What's love? I think I got this from Piper. Love is joyfully putting the needs of others above your own. That's a good definition of love. Not just grudgingly putting the needs of others ahead of your own. It is joyfully putting the needs of others ahead of your own. Blomberg defines it as costly self-sacrifice for another's good. But there has to be an element of joy, otherwise it's not love. If your child were completely and totally obedient and nothing else, could you say that your child loves you? I mean, if you pull the emotion, the joy out of it, if your spouse were perfectly obedient to you, would you say that your spouse loved you? No, you'd say that your spouse and your kids are terrified of you. Terrified. What else would produce absolute obedience apart from joy? So you got to get the element of joy in there. And I'd heard definitions like thinking the other is more important than yourself. Well, Jesus thought we were more important than him because we're not more important than him. So that's why I really like the definition, joyfully putting the needs of others above your own. And that love shows itself in our willingness to pray for them. Bonhoeffer says, loving our enemies means we walk side by side with our enemy into the throne room of heaven to plead your enemy's case before your heavenly Father. Now, I have no idea how to do that, but that's what Bonhoeffer says. Walk side by side with your enemy into the throne room of heaven and plead your enemy's case before your heavenly Father. Doesn't mean we're it's so late in the day. The nouns are, Gordon Fee said to me once, it's always the nouns that go first. you don't know the background of that. Gordon has advanced Alzheimer's. And the last time we were together, he was just diagnosed as having Alzheimer's. And I was asking, he was almost done with his rewrite of his commentary, and I asked him, how are you doing with God? You know, he's taking your mind away. Of all people, you know, maybe it'd been better to start with your body because there's so much in Gordon's head. And Gordon said, that's been a good run. Now, isn't that incredibly biblical, 2 Timothy? Isn't it a great evaluation of life? It's been a good run. I'm ready to go. It's been a good run. Then I asked him, okay, are you going to get your commentary finished? And he goes, you know, Bill, it's the nouns are the first to go. I can't think of a noun after noon. So what do you, I said, what do you do? He said, I get up at 6. And I write till noon, and then I stop. If I write past noon, the next morning I got to rewrite it all again. So that's the background. It's the nouns that are the first to go. Anyway, I forgot what I was trying to say altogether. Walk side by side with your enemy into the throne room of heaven to plead your enemy's case before your heavenly Father. Doesn't mean you're undiscerning, right? There are what the love looks like is going to vary from person to person and situation to situation. The only loving thing to do with a sexually abusive husband who's molesting your daughter is to put him in jail or get him out of harm's way. What is the story? We had a friend we knew at an old church that had been in jail, served his time, got out, was rearrested because he was meeting realtors in apartments, dousing them with gas and burning them alive. And he had just stood up in church at we used to call it a witness stand, where he would give his testimony. That Friday, he tried to burn a gal to death. And went back to jail, and when the worship pastor, who was especially close to him, went to see him in jail, he said, you know, I need to be here. I'm not safe. I simply can't control the sickness in me. I need to be protected for myself. I'm protected here. That's a pretty interesting comment. Started a jail ministry and witnessed to, led people to the Lord. He wasn't safe for him to be out. For other people, it's not safe to their victims to be out. That's what I'm saying. The loving your enemies is going to take all kinds of different forms. It doesn't mean you have to open yourself up to abuse. It means you have to be wise, you have to be discerning, but you have to willingly put the needs of the other person ahead of yourself, right? And the only way to do that is to understand that's what our Father did, and that's what we need to do if we want to be like Him. So the final charge is be perfect. And again, we'll never be perfect till heaven, but we can grow, and this is what we were talking about earlier, in ever-increasing measures, we can grow in maturity and in wholeness and in completeness. Jesus is so patient with us, isn't He? He's so patient. And He nudges, He nurtures, He disciplines, He pulls us along, He's with us when we fail. He pulls us up. He empowers us to move forward. He spanks us when we need to be spanked. Kicks us when we need to be kicked. Always moving forward. And that's the joy of the journey. And we're moving towards perfection. And someday, when we die, we will be whole. We will be complete because sin will be removed. We'll never be God, but we will be perfect as perfect men and perfect women. As perfect people. But I'm going to do everything I can by God's power to get as close to it as possible because the journey is really good. Let me close with saying this about my daughter. Kirsten's an amazing person, and she's been through some very traumatic experiences, and being attacked today is not at the top of her list, but it's up at the top of her list, I'm sure. And the amazing thing about Kirsten is that suffering either drives us away from God or drives us toward God. Isn't it the case? And when I look at Kirsten and things that have happened to her and whatnot, the suffering has driven her to Jesus. And while this was a scary thing to happen, it will increase her faith because that's just who she is. And it will draw her closer. And yes, there may be triggers and things that concern us, but she's on the journey towards wholeness. And God, as Johnny Erickson taught us, says, sometimes God allows things he hates to accomplish things he loves. And he loves her, and he will work in the midst of difficult circumstances to draw her to herself, to ever-increasing wholeness. That's what this is about. It's not a list of do's and don'ts. It's a list of what happens when we fully understand who we are and who God is and the journey that he pulls us on. So our prayer is that for all of us, that we enjoy the journey of moving toward perfection. Okay? All right. Thank you all. Appreciate your prayers. And we will get into prayer, another topic that there are no theological questions about prayer. So we'll probably just whip through prayer tomorrow. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is Dr. Bill Mounts in his teaching on the Sermon on the Mount. This is session number 8, Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 and following, Acts of Greater Righteousness, part 3.